Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
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 This morning's reading is from Canto 3, Chapter 2. We'll cover at least 28 and 29. And for those of you that like childhood pastimes of Krishna, that's what you're when you get your favorite. Spoken by Uddhava, or summarized. The background we did yesterday, Uddhava. Krishna's just left. He performed his worldly pastimes and he prepared Uddhava that he was going to leave. And he's gone. And Uddhava's feeling terrible grief. Not only in separation, but in contemplating the inexplicable pastimes, seemingly contradictory features of his pastimes that worldly persons can't understand. But he's made it, before describing Krishna's pastimes, we're prepared by Uddhava speaking to appreciate as he's speaking that Krishna's pastimes are not to be seen as that of an ordinary person or even an extraordinary person, but he's a transcendental person. He's the Lord of all existence and he's exchanging loving dealings in a very delightful way. So he's appreciating now the delightfulness of his pastimes, starting with yesterday was his birth and then being transferred to Gokul by Vasudeva, his father, and the forest scene where the calves and the cowherd boys would roam every day along the banks of the river Jumna. The trees, just like being in a forever garden. The trees and the chirping birds and the creepers and the fragrances and the sounds and just a delightful, delightful atmosphere. He's making the point also that by Uddhava speaking this way, although Krishna's pastimes are no longer manifest, both he and Vidura were able to access Krishna and his pastimes by the remembrance of him, because they were in Vrindavan and the abode of the Lord is as transcendental as the Lord is, and his pastimes may be manifest but by hearing and chanting about them one can be in touch with them. So by sound vibration they were manifest. So text 28. When the Lord displayed his activities just suitable for childhood, he was visible only to the residents of Vrindavan. Sometimes he would cry and sometimes laugh, just like a child. And while doing so, he would appear like a lion cub. So, what's that metaphor? Like a lion cub, we have kittens and puppies, but not lion cubs. So, commonly the Vedic literature and our acharyas liken the lion to the king of the jungle, where in the mature stage all animals flee in fear of here comes the lion. In fact, there's one description somewhere. There's a particular type of bird that makes a very shrill sound, and when a lion is on the prowl looking for food, he flies here and there making the shrill sound. It's kind of like a fire siren. All the animals know, oh, the lion's on the prowl, and they run. And what can the lion do? Because the bird is flying and you can't stop him. So he's alerting all the other animals. Here comes the lion, head for cover. So the lion is feared by everybody, all the jungle animals. But a lion cub, just playful, cute, innocent, harmless, rolling on his back and doing silly things. No one's afraid. So Krishna in his childhood pastimes would sometimes cry, sometimes laugh, and while so doing he would appear like a lion cub. Report by Srila Prabhupada. If anyone wants to enjoy the childhood pastimes of the Lord, then he has to follow in the footsteps of the residents of Braja, like Nanda, Upananda, and other parental inhabitants. A child may insist on having something so that what that is reference to he was visible only to the residents of Vrindavan, and specifically the very Gokul, even now, is very remote. So the other parts of Vrindavan, even, but to speak of the other forests, people didn't see him because he was off in some remote place. So to enter into that, not only one has to be in the right geographic location, but one has to be in the right mood. Otherwise, not entitled to understand, what to speak of, even see Krishna. A child may insist on having something and cry like anything to get it, disturbing the whole neighborhood. And immediately, after achieving the desired thing, he laughs. Such crying and laughing is enjoyable to the parents and elderly members of the family. So, the Lord would simultaneously cry and laugh in this way and merge his devotee parents in the humor of transcendental pleasure. These incidents are enjoyable only by the residents of Braja like Nanda Maharaj, and not by the impersonalist worshippers of Brahman or Paramatma. Sometimes, when attacked in the forest by demons, Krishna would appear struck with wonder. But he looked on them like the cub of a lion and killed them. His childhood pastimes, his childhood companions, would narrate the story to their parents, and everyone would appreciate the qualities of their Krishna. Child Krishna did not belong only to his parents, Nanda and Yashoda. He was the son of all the elderly inhabitants of Braja, and the friend of all the contemporary boys and girls. Everyone loved Krishna. He was the life and soul of everyone, including the animals, the cows, and the calves. go back to the theme that Uddhava mentioned and Prabhupada has amplified. The pastimes of Krishna are nothing but super excellent exchanges of loving relationships. Krishna enjoys those pastimes. He enjoys, the remark has been made, he enjoys those pastimes far more than being worshipped with great majesty and veneration by those who worship him in awe and reverence. We're making a comparison between this kind of love and that kind of love. And the love of intimacy is appreciated by Krishna even more. Of course, we could compare love and the absence of that love, and Krishna wants that love. But even between the two kinds of love, even more, this intimacy. And with the intimacy, parental, friendship, conjugal, servitorship, there's, even in the servitorship, there's intimacy. The classic from Nectar Devotion is Daruka. When Krishna was out of Vrindavan, he also had a devotee that served him named Daruka. Daruka was the chariot driver of Krishna. Whenever Krishna would want to get his chariot and go somewhere, you just give the order to Daruka, and Daruka would have it ready. But within Vrindavan, there was another cowherd boy named Daruka, a different personality. And he liked serving Krishna. He was his friend, but his mood more was serving. So he would, when Krishna would become tired, which Krishna is another contradiction, he who has no material body, and he who is all powerful becomes tired. It's like saying the sun becomes tired. When the sun becomes tired, or when Krishna becomes tired, Daruka would fan Krishna of a nice cooling breeze while Krishna was resting. But there's an intimacy there also, not just the majestic Lord and all pomp and splendor. He would fan the Lord. But Krishna would be resting by the roots of a tree, protruding roots in the lap of the tree, as the saying goes. He'd be lying, leaning against the tree, and Daruka would come and fan Krishna while he was resting. Very intimate. And in this way, the comment is, Krishna was the life and soul of everyone. The adults, the children, boys and girls, the animals, the birds, even the trees, even the creepers, the river Jamuna. Krishna was the delight of all the inhabitants of Vrindavan. While herding the very beautiful bulls, the Lord, who was the reservoir of all opulence and fortune, used to blow upon his flute, and thus he enlivened his faithful followers, the cowherd boys. So now he's a little older, 6 or 7 years old. The Lord was thus given charge of looking after the cows and bulls in the grazing grounds. There's a, in one of the writings of either Jiva or Rupa Goswami, there's a description of a ceremony when Krishna was first to take out the calves. Very, very nice. All Mother Jasoda would need is some excuse to have a big festival, and so she'd have a big festival. Krishna's going to take out the calves. And the description goes that normally one would have to be of a certain age, but Krishna was very expert, so even he was much younger and they allowed. But that means, think of some child that's 4 years old. So Krishna and Balaram have a big festival. And everyone brings gifts to Krishna. And in the description, Mother Jasoda brings some shoes, because normally the children would go barefoot, but now he's going to go out in the forest, so he's got to have shoes. So she acquired some shoes that had shiny little mylar-like little pieces, or pieces of mirror embedded in the shoes with a little pointed toe. You've seen. She gave the shoes to Krishna, and he wouldn't even take them. He put his hands behind his back, but I can't take these shoes. And Mother Jasoda said, why not? Because we're protecting the cows. And if we're going to wear shoes, then the cows should wear shoes too. And Mother Jasoda said, but Nanda Maharaj has so many calves. 900,000 cows, so there's so many calves. And Krishna said, you make shoes for each of the four hooves of each of the calves, and then I'll wear the shoes. But otherwise, I won't wear the shoes. Doesn't say what happened after that. But his Krishna's message in a very innocent, childlike way was, when we're protecting the cows, we're protecting, we give great care and appreciation and affection to those who we are protecting. So if we're protecting the cows, we can't have this and they have nothing. Treat with great dignity and respect those who are extended protection. So here's, he's 6 and 7, or 6 or 7, and he's graduated from the calves to the cows. So now it's the cows and the bulls. He was the son of a well-to-do landlord who owned hundreds and thousands of cows. 9 lakhs of cows. And according to Vedic economics, one is considered to be a rich man by the strength of his store of grains and cows. With only these two things, cows and grain, human society can solve its eating problem. Human society needs only sufficient grain and sufficient cows to solve its economic problems. I said it 3 times. All other things but these two are artificial necessities created by man to kill his valuable life at the human level and waste his time in things which are not needed. Lord Krishna, as the teacher of human society, personally showed by his acts that the mercantile community, or the Vaishyas, should herd cows and bulls and thus give protection to the valuable animals. According to the Smriti regulation, the cow is the mother and the bull is the father of human being. The cow is the mother because just as one sucks the breast of one's mother, human society takes cow's milk. Similarly, the bull is the father of human society because the father earns for the children just as the bull tills the ground to produce food grains. Human society will kill its spirit of life by killing the father and the mother. It is mentioned herein that the beautiful cows and bulls were of various checkered colors: red, black, green, yellow, ash, etc. Doesn't mention that in the verse, but somehow our acharyas give this. And because of their colors and healthy smiling features, the atmosphere was enlivening. Over and above all, the Lord used to play his celebrated flute. The sound, vibrated by his flute, would give his friends such transcendental pleasure that they would forget all the tasks of the Brahmananda, which is so praised by the impersonalists. The cowherd boys, as will be explained by Shukadev Goswami, were living entities who had accumulated heaps of pious acts and thus were enjoying with the Lord in person and were hearing his transcendental flute. In the Brahma Samhita 5:30, it is confirmed that the Brahma Samhita 5:30 confirms the Lord's blowing his transcendental flute. Venum kanvantam aravinda dalaya taksham barhavatamsam asitam buddha sundarangam kandarpakoti kamaniya vishesha shobham govindam adipurusham tamaham vajami. Brahmaji said, I worship Govinda, the primeval Lord, who plays on his transcendental flute. His eyes are like lotus flowers, he is decorated with peacock plumes, and his bodily color resembles a fresh black cloud, although his bodily features are more beautiful than millions of cupids. These are the special features of the Lord. These are little meditations on the childhood pastimes of Krishna by Uddhava. The cultural point, besides Krishna likes cows, the cultural point is Krishna was showing within, by his own example, within Vedic society, or within even modern society, necessities of life come from grains and cows. Before, there was the industrial type of economy, the agricultural-based economy that was wealth, grains and cows, and things were, wealthy persons were measured by how many cows and how much grain. When the king, who was ruling his citizens, would receive taxes, the taxes would come in that form, grain and milk products. And that's what his treasury was filled with, along with jewels and other valuables. But other than the king, the worldly person, the average person, was producing, economy was agriculture, because that's of necessity. in the world today, there's a big concern. Those who are strategists looking into the future and seeing trends, the shortage of water and food, big problems. Certainly in America, that talk has been there for quite some time. I remember when Obama was first becoming, you know, just before his inauguration, the main talk at the time was the crash of the economy. But these forecasters were saying during this president's administration, the shortage of food is going to become a huge concern during this, just this present administration. And not doomsday type of speakers, but, you know, just economists that are hired to make sure that we're thinking ahead and what the trends are. And a big part of it is, comes from water. If you have sufficient water, or the right amount, not too much, then it's better for crop production. But the irregularities of water, so it's tied to performance of sacrifice, and it's also tied to persons being thoughtful about what necessities are and turning their attention to necessities rather than to that which isn't necessity. Or stated otherwise, the overall, when Prabhupada came to the West, he brought with him the first canto Bhagavatam. And there's so many places in the first canto Bhagavatam speaking this message of the five things that need to be given protection, because Maharaj Pariksit giving protection to the bull. The legs were being broken. So lots of discussion about protection of the brahmanas and the cows and the elderly and the women and children. And of the two, it's the brahmanas and the cows, most important amongst the five. Because when those two are in place, then the others will be more naturally in place, and those two aren't in place, the other three aren't going to be in place, and the rest of society goes to hell. Brahminical culture and cow protection. So with all of that, Prabhupada was establishing temples in the cities where you don't have cow protection. So after some time, he established that there should be, for temples we were in the cities for preaching, and the example setting of simple living, high thinking, that was a phrase that Prabhupada used again and again, simple living, high thinking. For temples, urban centers that were strong enough and stable, they could then begin, or they should then begin, looking for some land where they could show cow protection and simple living, high thinking, as an example. That was when our temples were strong, and that same focus hasn't been fulfilled, in part because our temples aren't strong, at least in North America, not like they were during Prabhupada's time. So the attention needs to continue to go to making the temples strong. But just as Krishna, he's commenting, Krishna was showing by his own example the role of grains and cows. For that you need land, you need rain. The Vedic system was, one didn't have to go and buy some land, because there wasn't any buying of land. It was, you know, the mighty king ruled the land. His sword and his prowess ruled the land. And then there was the arrangement where there were landholders, and they would take charge of this piece or that piece of land under the king and give their taxes to the king, and that was the system of production. Now it's, you know, what, getting the money to buy a mortgage or get a mortgage and get a mortgage approved, and mortgages aren't getting approved, and it's a whole thing. For people to go down the path of starting agriculture, it's the other way around. Those that have farms get squeezed and squeezed and squeezed and squeezed. Anyway, that's a whole story. Until they just can't do it anymore. They can't afford it, and so they sell to the expansion of industrialization. And they have food shortages. In the purport, Prabhupada is speaking of Krishna playing upon his flute. And by playing upon his flute, those who were in his association, particularly the cowherd boys are mentioned, but the flute would be heard by all. The birds that were flying in the air would become stunned, and they'd fall to the ground. And the rivers that were flowing stopped so they could hear the sound of Krishna's flute. So everything that was moving would stop, become still. And everything that was still, like the rocks, it would start to flow. Everything became reverse, just by hearing Krishna's flute. So he charmed the hearts completely of the inhabitants of Vrindavan. And tomorrow we're going to hear about demons and the river Jamuna during the Kaliya Leela. The river Jamuna becoming poisoned by the demon Kaliya. Hare Krishna. Any discussion on the Krishna Katha that we've been hearing from Uddhava? Very pleasing to the heart. It's not the kind of thing that makes one question.
Yes. Thank you. You were talking about making the temple like the temple being strong. So how? What makes a temple strong?
One of the things that was making the temple strong during Prabhupada's time was the numbers of devotees. Many devotees, so many devotees, bursting at the seams. And with the so many devotees, then so many, what you do in cities. Why, otherwise, why be in a city? And that's, go out and encourage people to take to Krishna consciousness. Harinam, book distribution, and other forms of prasada distribution, outreach activity. And so many more people were learning about Krishna consciousness and coming and participating at the temple. So, that was the strong. It was life. Lots of preaching activity and lots of devotees coming from that preaching activity. Of different stages of commitment, but, you know, many full-time. There was not, during that time, there was not, as there is today, a very good strong conception of congregation. In fact, a term we didn't even use. It was, the conception was, you're in or you're out. We even had an ISKCON term called fringy. They weren't in. So it wasn't congregation, it was fringy. You're not in. And in meant householders, brahmacharis, brahmacharinis, living in the temple. There was not a concept of a congregation equally participating from their household position, coming to the temple as their schedules permitted and participating outside with the same level of commitment as those that were living inside the temple. So, that was our way of thinking, our not very mature way of thinking. But that it did have an effect that many people joined the temple because that was either you're in or you're out. And they wanted to be in. Not, they didn't want to be out. I mean, that's just a sociological comment. The more practical thing is there are lots of devotees in the temples. So this gave certain groups of devotees something to do that suited their nature. Some were very happy to go to the farm. I remember some of the earlier ones that when we started the farm, Gudakesh was one. And he was doing sankirtan, but it wasn't really his nature. And when the opportunity came, he lived in the farm for, 15 years. And he would take the oxen and go into the forest, and the trees that had naturally fallen, he would drag them with the ox behind the oxen, put a chain around the oxen, and they would happily drag the fallen trees, and that became their firewood. And so many things he would do for the farm. And he was very, very happy. Or the devotees in New Brajadam describe when they got the idea from Budapest to have a farm. There were three people who really just were kind of, not productive. So they were given to the farm project. But, it was because it was their nature. And today, they're the strongest people in the agriculture department. They just love being out in the field with the animals and plowing and harvesting and planting. So this, your question, what is it, what did it mean and why? There were lots of devotees engaged in outreach activity. And the deity worship was well-staffed, cooking department well-staffed, everything. And take the next step. That's what we did. Some places, at least in North America and in Europe. Through your work or through your finance are obvious ones. Like, I was thinking this last night with the gathering there as householders. You're not in the city or you're not at a temple, but you're connecting with young people whose lives are not yet calcified. They're deciding many things about their lives, and you're helping to shape, or at least give opportunity, if not also shape, how they'll lead the rest of their lives. So while you're here, that's a very, very valuable service as householders to the temples as well as to the movement. I mean, I didn't get a chance to speak with all the persons there, but the few that I spoke to, as the conversation was going on, I was envisioning, you know, this one, that one, the other one, how they, their lives might, from this position of university, move into some situation where they're near a temple. So you're helping to prepare them for that eventuality, that service to a temple. That's what I did, or let's say what there was some history that I heard recently . I forget where I heard it. Some man, when Prabhupada was speaking at 26 Second Avenue, some man was hearing Srila Prabhupada and said to Srila Prabhupada, "I live in Buffalo and New York, and I'm willing to finance a center. If you would like to send somebody there, I'll finance a center, and it's right near university." And so Prabhupada immediately agreed. I didn't know that history. That man was participating for some time, continuing in New York, and then at some point in time he drifted. I don't know what happened. But the idea came from someone, so from the city, to do something at a further away place, and the further away place they picked Rupanuga to take responsibility for that center. And from that center, maybe 25 full-time devotees who became leaders of our movement all over the world came from that place, from that college center. And that was useful service for our temples, although it was more remote. It served the world. And Prabhupada said a number of things. Now I'm speaking specifically about colleges. That wasn't your particular question, but because we're at a college. Prabhupada made a remark on more than one occasion that one person who's intelligent, well-educated and intelligent, he's worth 10 persons because that person can give leadership to 10 persons. That was a strategy that Prabhupada exercised. Where there were qualified persons to lead college centers, he had them go to college centers and establish outreach programs at those college centers. And then those were the persons who became the leaders of his movement that he deployed all around the world, literally. So that's a nice service. And another, how can you conserve the temples as grihasthas when you complete your studies and you're in an earning position, something that has been a practice for Penn State for the past number of years, 5-6 years, is there's a coordination of persons who would like to contribute to help Gita Nagari, and they combine their funds and something goes to Gita Nagari. So that what was done and is still going on is at one point the main building had a leak in the roof, or many leaks in the roof. So they, and Gita Nagari didn't have the means to take care of that. So a temple gave the loan, fixed the roof, and that temple is now being paid back for fixing the roof, for that loan that fixed the roof. And then and another project was the septic system was like a dinosaur. So that was replaced, and part of it was taken care of by a donation, and part of it was the same. A loan was given to cover the rest, and the students that graduated from Penn State are in the process of completing paying back that loan, so that they now have a septic system that works. And there's a list of things that are needed to help build or make renovations at the farm so it's operable. That's, you know, when the capacity is there for earning, then some, according to means, some capacity of contributing goes to one fund, so it goes, you know, to the Penn State Student Graduate Fund, and it's covering things that the farm requires as a service. Those are two very valuable men and money. Now the rate of young people joining the Hare Krishna movement is not the same. Certainly not becoming full-time persons. It's not the same. Those from meeting people who can then become participants in some either some practical service or contributing, it's valuable. That's valuable service. Even one may be remote from a temple like here. Or future circumstances. And skills that you're learning presently, you'll be able to use, you know, for your life as devotees. How to receive guests, how to introduce them, how to engage them, how to take care of them, how to help guide them in making important decisions in their life, and so on. You're getting that training now. That's valuable service throughout your life. Okay. Anything else? Can you speak a little louder?
Can I ask one more question?
Yeah.
This is about the appearance of, like yesterday you were talking about Lord Krishna's appearance, and one thing I always had doubt about, I mean, I didn't know much about was Subhadra Devi, like, could you tell, like, let us know a little about her, like how she appeared and her?
There's not any detailed information here. In the latter part of the 10th canto, there's mention only that she was the younger sister, the daughter of Vasudeva and Devaki. No detail. There may be detail elsewhere that I'm unaware of, but within the Bhagavatam, it's only that much is mentioned. Okay. Thank you very much. Srila Prabhupada, you got it.
Is Hari Das Prabhupada Swami Maharaj ki
jai? I had this question on right now we are involved in doing so many things like going to work and doing other stuff. So how do we base our priorities? Like when we have to do certain things, how do we base our priorities? That's one first question. And the second question is, for example, in a husband and wife relationship, how do you respect the other person's priority? That's the second question. Again, going back to my first question, placing priorities in the sense, sometimes we'll have a list of item 1, item 2, item 3, item 4, and maybe item 4 is what I like, but item 1 is what needs to be done now. So how do I make a decision of choosing?
You've answered your question.
By the very nature of the question, the way that you framed the question. Let's just assume that sadhana takes the first priority, and that's understood. And it's not, somehow, somewhere, during the course of the day, I'll get my... But another kind of priority, that is, it comes first, and I build my day around that, not I build that around my day. Some here, some there. It's a priority for my... all of my service, so that I can be strong and a fit instrument of Krishna. Strong sadhana is priority, assuming that's in place. the very example that you gave, out of the four things, there's one that I really like to do, and that's not priority. The priority is what's really important. And that's what's priority. Now, how do I understand what's important? Well, it's first of all, you can eliminate it's important because it's what I like. That's not what makes it important. It's not about what you like, it's about what's important. And so, a lot of determining what's important has to do with circumstances. Like yesterday was a program. And so certain things need to get done because that's a program. You can't do the things I like before those things that need to get done for the program because it's the day of a program. So circumstances may dictate what's important. Or principles may dictate what's important. And when you start going down that path, well, what are principles that are important that then determine what things to be done are important? I would say the mission of Krishna consciousness and relationships behind or beneath sadhana. In other words, getting something done may take a lower position than the relationships amongst the devotees. I may choose to not get something done because what's more important priority-wise is the relationship among the devotees. I may forego or not give the same sense of urgency, full throttle urgency to get something done at the expense of the relationships amongst the devotees. Because in the long run, the relationships is what's most important, priority-wise. But at the same time, we need to be practical. We also need to get something done. So then out of that prioritization, what's most important to see that it gets done? And how to determine those priorities of starts in the family, and it spills into the second one. How do you respect the priorities of your spouse, you know, husband or wife? It's respecting the person and having sufficient communication so that both parties' set of values are understood and shared. And they may not be precisely the same, but I respect them because I respect the person and I value the relationship. And so while I might prefer X instead of, you know, A instead of C, and they prefer C instead of A, I respect that because that's them and that's fine. While they're respecting that I value A especially. And so there's sometimes give and take. Sometimes this, sometimes that. That's part of how a loving relationship goes. It's not always, you know, one side or always the other side. There's give and take in a loving relationship. Because in that case, you place the relationship above the priorities. That's the priority, is the relationship. You're investing in the relationship. Committing to the relationship. That's more important than whether it's A or C. And when that's the position between husband and wife, then it can be A or it can be C, and it's not an issue. And there's not keeping score. So many times it's been C instead of A, and I should get some A time over here. Because the relationship is more important than who wins and who loses. This because it's not a win-lose relationship. So there should be adequate communication so that the two parties understand what's important to them. And in course of time, what's important to one becomes what's important to the other, and vice versa. And so both get covered. Perhaps in varying proportions at different times. And gradually their values become shared. Set their sensibilities about priorities. And it can get into all kinds of things, finance and time allotments and how much internal and how much external activity. So many things. So the priority is the commitment to the relationship, and the following, flowing from that comes, you know, respecting one another's priorities. And that takes time. but you won't get time without the commitment. It starts with commitment. It's very valuable to have guidance through that process. Not someone who's going to make the decisions for you, but guidance through the process of someone who's been through that and understands how to have the kind of communication that goes on respectfully and happily and lovingly. Although we're two different individuals. You have something?
Yeah, thinking of myself of right now, I might be graduating and those kind of things.
I hope so.
In 1 year, maybe. It's highly unclear that what is kind of role I have assisting the movement. And my question is how to be clear myself what is the role I have and how to best prepare.
Well, sometimes clarity takes time. You know, they start with principles and then details follow principles. What are some of the gifts that Krishna has given you? And take a little inventory of what they are. And then consider, okay, with these gifts, there's part what I like to do. But there's also there's the world around me and what seems to be of value that some of the gifts that Krishna has given me I can use. And probably because of we can't see our own autobiography as well as someone that's close to us can help us see. So some guidance is most valuable. Someone more experienced also, most valuable. It's several things at once. It's simultaneously ruling out, you know, of the world of possibilities. Some things are just are not as important, or not as meaningful, so that you eliminate some things and you leave some things. And of those, things that are remaining, both internally, what seems to inspire the most, and then externally, where might there be some application that's particularly suited, especially if there's if Krishna is sending a resource of making the connection between capacity and need. Personal capacity and as an external need. That's an important factor to consider. Is Krishna giving a message here? and guidance again, because, gee, I don't know what, I've been so involved in my studies, I don't know what the world of ISKCON is all about. In the same way as somebody that's been very much involved in the world of ISKCON and hasn't been involved in studies like I have. So it's natural. Not just in isolation I make some decisions, but in consultation I make some decisions.
There is a pressure of contributing significant contribution, that kind of pressure, like if I take some service, that kind of, how to, am I clear?
Not exactly. It's the emphasis is going to be substantial.
Yeah, I'm concerned.
But something substantial takes time. You may start with, this is my experience. It's not as, let's take the example of a financial contribution. A or B. Substantial contribution could mean when I'm very wealthy, then I'll begin contributing financially to the cause of this kind, cause of the society, the work of Prabhupada's mission. Or B, whatever my capacity is, in principle, I'll contribute something. And because the principle is being observed over a period of time, as my capacity increases, so also the nominal amount will also increase. Which is the better model? And if you were Krishna, who would you be prepared to give more resource to, person A or person B? So if you want to do something substantial, then begin in principle. And watch it grow according to whatever design Krishna has. Being very careful to manage whatever that is that Krishna sends your way. As ability, as capacity, as skill, as finance, or whatever it is. When you base your life principle centered, and you've selected the right principles, it's wisely principle based, things will grow naturally to something substantial, whatever that something is. I'll give a very different kind of example than money. Book distribution. Now I want to do something substantial, so I should. I know Prabhupada valued book distribution, but what's the point of being a book distributor if I can't do something substantial? Of the people that I spoke to last night, one of them that came because the black woman that was sitting in the front, she got a book. And she said, she thought to herself when she was offered the opportunity to get the book, I haven't read any book in my whole college time, other than my academic books. I'll buy one book, which she didn't read. And when she saw the flyer, she then made the connection. Oh, that's the same place as where that book came from. Although I haven't read the book, so I'll just come to the program out of curiosity. And, you know, very nice exchange, and her life is in a position where she's considering, you know, it's a very valuable event that she had received that book, because then it meant association of devotees, and we'll see what else comes from that. So how substantial is that? I would say very substantial. Or another example of book distribution. One devotee couple in the Chicago area, the